that I can come out of that safely. I'd hope to ride the rapport of Mr. Kirk with the audience into my own little presentation here, and now I have to break the ice. And now Mr. Vivas has given me this introduction, which will make it perhaps impossible to get to first base with you, since I assure you he has grossly exaggerated what he had to say about my expertise in connection with Dostoevsky. I'm a political scientist. I'm not a professor of aesthetics or philosophy, nor a professional student of Russian literature. I feel quite confident in telling you that I am an amateur in the interpretation of Dostoevsky, and please do not believe what Eliseo just told you, because he is grossly exaggerated. And at the very beginning, I come on a stumbling point. It is a problem of the relationship of literature and social order. I have studied Dostoevsky because it seems to me that he has meaningful things to say about the political order. I was drawn to the study of Dostoevsky precisely on that ground. A great many professional political theorists, those who ostensibly have important things to say about the political and social order in which we live, very often seem to me to be speaking beside the point. Almost by accident, I came to the reading of Dostoevsky and discovered that he seemed to be saying some things that were very much to the point. And yet, in attempting to rationalize the problem, how one can take a great poet, in this case, a novelist, and derive from him a theory of politics, I must confess that methodologically, I haven't ironed out all the wrinkles, and I wrote a book about Dostoevsky without really attempting to resolve that problem. I want to begin, though, by making a few comments in that connection with very certain anticipation that Professor Vivas will find a way to pick holes in what I suggest may be the connection, and we can continue a friendly debate which has gone on now for the past 6 or 7 months sporadically in this regard. An expression that has always impressed me as being somewhat to the present point was made once by Jacques Maritain when he stated that metaphysics and great music traverse the same realms of being, or something to that effect. It seems to me that there is a common concern and a common intellectual operation that philosophers and poets both engage in when they address the fundamental issues of human existence. And whether their mode of expression is music or a poem or a novel, it seems that there is, as Maritain has argued, an essential rationality that is shared, even though the modes of rationality may differ quite profoundly. Now, my principal exposure to this kind of thing has been from reading Dostoevsky. And I am particularly impressed by Dostoevsky's starting point. Permit me to suggest to you what that starting point is when he wrote to his brother at age 19, "Man is a mystery. It must be unraveled. And if you give your life to the task, do not think that you wasted it. I devote myself to this mystery because I wish to be a man." I would submit from age 19 until his very last days, Dostoevsky was essentially engaged in the unraveling of the mystery of man, and that the artifacts that he created along the way, particularly the great writings of the post-Siberian years, seemed to me to be so thoroughly permeated by an essentially philosophical concern that regardless of how one, in terms of a theory of aesthetics, relates this to the activity of, say, a philosopher such as a Plato, that there is an essential analogy, if not unity, of enterprise and effort which binds the work of a man such as Dostoevsky to a task of exploring the mystery of man, the mystery of being, which is essentially philosophical. Philosophical in the root conception of what philosophy is. Now that root conception, since I know that there are a number of root conceptions as to what philosophy is, perhaps I should make explicit. That conception is the understanding of the philosopher as a lover of wisdom, which if we take from Plato, further definition of that, on the condition that one understands a philosopher himself is never wise, but that only the God is wise. This implies then, it seems to me, a series of conceptions which I have found useful, even if I have not systematically applied them in my own study of Dostoevsky. It is that the bridge of eros, of love, whether in philia or eros, which relates man to the highest dimensions of reality, that this is a passionate involvement, that the passionate involvement is apprehended in terms of man's participation in the whole of being, of which he is only a single representative, a representative of one man among others in a reality which is structured in terms of a community that philosophers call the community of being, which involves a partnership of participation between man and God, one's fellow man, the society which surrounds us, or surrounds all men, and the world on which and in whose order the society itself is an enclave, so that there is a series or a network of tensions which surround the self-reflective activities of the creative person, no less than the inquiring philosopher who seeks to represent the content of his participatory experiences in the various symbolisms by which men express themselves and communicate with themselves and to one another. It seems to me, short of elaborating or attempting to elaborate any kind of systematic theory of aesthetics, it seems to me that it's precisely this kind of activity that all reflective men share, whether philosophers, poets, or prophets, and the necessity of all to symbolize and to represent the content of their experiences, to do so in a way that is somehow meaningful, that somehow in the jargon of political science is intersubjectively transmissible to quote Arnold Brecht, that to do so is common to all of those who speak and speak meaningfully, whether they speak discursively or use the symbolisms available in the various modes of representation available through all the fine arts, as well as through philosophy and history. Now, Maritain speaks of creative intuition in this respect, he contrasts the poet's intuition with the mystic's intuition. He speaks of the poet desiring to express, the mystic desiring to be silent. And I would suggest that this conception of intuition, the creative intuition of the poet, the mystical intuition of the great religious contemplatives, shares an essential common ground with the kind of thing we see being done in philosophy, in the great philosophers, and particularly, of course, Plato again comes to mind. This dimension of rationality is one, however, which is comparatively ill-defined. To speak of creative intuition or mystical intuition is immediately to suggest, in common parlance, a kind of irrational something that happens which is unaccountable and which does not deserve the name of rationality. And yet, I think that the sources would suggest that this is indeed not the case. This dimension of rationality was still alive and explicitly known in, for example, 1651, when Milton talked about it in Paradise Lost, when he contrasted the rationality of intuition, as he has Raphael speaking to Adam, contrasting intuitive rationality with discursive or discoursing rationality. And if one pursues it back from that point, he discovers that in certain key passages, and I'm particularly fond of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, where the intellect or nous is defined as that faculty in man which enables him to grasp first principles which are not themselves demonstrable, but upon which all rationality depends. Now, Bergson, it seems to me, in the 20th century, has revived this concept more effectively and more persuasively than perhaps anyone else, and yet Bergson is never as explicit as I wished he had been in identifying intuition with rationality and with the Aristotelian nous. And yet the intuition whereby one grasps the thing, the whole of its reality, rather than analyzing it to pieces and spelling it out in the dissolvent work of, a scientific analysis. This essential act of intuition, which is foundational to any kind of metaphysical discussion and to metaphysics itself, was, after all, from the beginning of the 20th century, revived by Bergson, and revived by Bergson, I should say, on the basis of his own acquaintance with Aristotle, who understood the foundation of reason to be precisely this mysterious faculty in man whereby men apprehend the first principles, including the key principle of all ontology, being itself. Then there are other bits and pieces, flecks here and there, and for example, in Whitehead, who wrote the little book, The Function of Reason, who speaks in his Science in the Modern World of the scientist's faith in reason, suggesting, if you take the phrase literally, that underlying the scientist's rationality and the rational constructs which all modern science relies upon and which somehow brings to grip or grasp the material reality which scientists concern themselves with, that underlying that is an act of faith in the rationality, the rational structure, the order of the reality which they explore as scientists. And this leads to the further question, to what degree is faith, this faith in reason, to what degree is that faith in reason assimilable to faith in the biblical sense? Faith perhaps in the sense of the medieval writers who originally, so far as I can see, created the opposition between faith and reason. To what degree is faith as an experiential act itself assimilable to the noetic reason of a Plato and an Aristotle. And I am rather of the mind, although I can't prove it, and this wouldn't be the occasion to essay to do so, that a great deal of the celebrated opposition between faith and reason is simply a bogus problem. And I rather suspect that a great part of what is essential to faith, faith is, for example, analyzed in H. Richard Niebuhr's little book on Revelation, for example, that what is foundational to faith as it has been practiced for the two millennia of the Christian era is in very substantial degree assimilable to the kind of noetic rationality that Plato and Aristotle operate with. Now, Dostoevsky, for his part, and I don't pretend that this takes care of all of the issues between the philosophers and the poets, but there's an explanation there somewhere, and if you forgive me for thinking out loud a little bit, it seems to me the explanation lies somewhere in this particular area that I've been ruminating about. Dostoevsky, for his part, came to an awareness of this kind of problem very early in his biography, and he came to an awareness of the problem from reading Pascal. Pascal, you will remember, contrasts the reason of the head with the reason of the heart. The reason of the heart, I take to be the equivalent, and Pascal's explanation bears this out, of the noetic reason whereby we come to first principles, not simply logical first principles, but also ontological first principles. Pascal puts it this way: we know truth not only by reason, but also by the heart. And it is in this last way that we know first principles. Does sound familiar, doesn't it? And reason, which has no part in it, tries in vain to impugn them. It is the heart which naturally loves the universal being, which experiences God and not the reason. This, then, is faith. God felt by the heart, not by reason. Faith is a gift of God. Reason must trust these intuitions of the heart and must base on them every argument. Principles are intuited. Propositions are inferred. Now, Dostoevsky read Pascal when he was 17, and it stuck with him. Although, so far as I can see, he never got beyond speaking of the reason of the heart. He didn't know about noetic reason per se, but he understood quite thoroughly that there is a dimension to rationality other than that dimension which he constantly denigrates in his later life, keeping in mind that he was trained as a civil engineer, the so-called Euclidean reasoning. The Euclidean reasoning, which is the reason of analysis, the reason of the technician and scientist, the calculative reason, the kind that is organized, for example, in the books of logic from the time of Aristotle's Organon down through Bacon's work into modern logic. So that what I'm suggesting is that part of our difficulty here, I think, in relating not only the work of poets to science, but also the work of philosophers to science, is that we operate in some with a defective conception of what is rationality, and that reason, the reason with which we operate, is the equivalent of reasoning, which is calculative, inferential reason. And I would even suggest that the man who did more than anything else to be sure that this is what we do was my old friend John Locke, but that's another story. So, If you will, indulge me so as to expand reason from reasoning, so as to include intuition and not immediately interpret intuition as irrational to be contrasted with reason, because I don't think that is really justifiable to do. Now, Dostoevsky in 17 wrote at 17 now, I regress 2 years from the first quotation I gave to you, was pondering this question and wrote to his brother Michael as follows. What do you mean precisely by the word no? K-N-O-W. Nature, the soul, love, and God, one recognizes through the heart and not through the reason. Were we spirits, we could dwell in that region of ideas over which our souls hover, seeking the solution. But we are earth-born beings and can only guess at the idea, not grasp it by all sides at once. The guide for our intelligences through the temporary illusion into the innermost center of the soul is called reason. Now, reason is a material capacity, while the soul or spirit lives on the thoughts whispered by the heart. Thought is born in the soul. Reason is a tool, a machine, which is driven by the spiritual fire. When human reason penetrates into the domain of knowledge, it works independently of the feeling and consequently of the heart. But when our aim is the understanding of love or of nature, we march towards the very citadel of the heart. Philosophy cannot be regarded as a mere equation where nature is the unknown quantity. Remark that the poet, in the moment of inspiration, comprehends God and consequently does the philosopher's work. Consequently, poetic inspiration is nothing less than philosophical inspiration. Consequently, philosophy is nothing but poetry, a higher degree of poetry. It is odd that you reason quite in the sense of our contemporary philosophy, which is to say, particularly the positivists. What a lot of crazy systems have been born of late in the cleverest and most ardent brains. To get a right result from this motley troop, one would have to subject all of them to a mathematical formula, and yet they are the laws of our contemporary philosophy. I think this is a rather striking illustration of the acuity with which Dostoevsky assessed at age 17, and he didn't forget it as I read his later writing, the truncation of reason, which had occurred and which was an affliction not only to the work of philosophy, but to the very understanding that men in the name of modernity and science were fostering in the Russia in which he was a young man and in which he lived. Now this, I think, suggests the problematic of Dostoevsky's political orientation, using politics as I do in a very broad sense. Politics I take to be the science of order. The science of order insofar as man participates in order. And this means that it not only embraces what goes on Courthouse Square or in the marketplace there at the foot of the Acropolis, but it embraces the whole range of man's ordering activities insofar as he realizes himself to participate in all of the levels of reality, from the simply physical and sentient to the upper levels of emotion and spiritual and intellectual life. This is because the understanding of rationality that had been fostered in the, particularly the 18th century in the West, had been exported to Russia in the process of Westernization that occurred apace, particularly following the French Revolution. and took among numerous other forms not only the adulation of science, but also the exportation of the thought of leading Western thinkers from Rousseau onward, so that in Dostoevsky's youth, we're now talking about the period from 1821, when he was born, down to his sentence to go to Siberia, 1849. In this period, all of the isms had become the fascination of the educated elite of the universities, those with whom Dostoevsky was acquainted, the circles with whom he regularly consorted, and especially the striking figure of Vissarion Jibalinsky, who discovered Dostoevsky and created a mutual admiration society after Poor Folk had been written, and Dostoevsky was hailed by Belinsky, the leading literary critic of the day, as a new Gogol, which to a young man of 24 or 25 was indeed quite a reception. And in a sense, Dostoevsky was educated politically, and very largely, therefore, he was ideologically educated at the hands of Belinsky, who was himself in a passage between positivism and radical socialism in this period. It becomes then interesting to give a sample, at least, of what Belinsky's doctrine was, so I think that you can see the contour of the adversary against whom I believe Dostoevsky is contending in the great novels of the period from Crime and Punishment to the end of his life in 1881. Belinsky wrote, "I am at a new extreme, which is the idea of socialism that has become for me the idea of ideas, the being of beings, a question of questions, the alpha and omega of belief and knowledge. It is the be-all and end-all. It is a question and its solution. It has for me engulfed history and religion and philosophy, and hence I now use it to explain my life, yours and everybody's whom I have met on the path of life. My God is negation. In history, my heroes are the destroyers of the old. Luther, Voltaire, the encyclopedists, the terrorists, Byron, Cain, and so on. I prefer the blasphemies of Voltaire to acknowledging the authority of religion, society, or anything or anybody. I know that the Middle Ages were a great epoch, but I prefer the 18th century, the epoch of religion's decline. In the Middle Ages, heretics, freethinkers, and witches were burned at the stake. In the 18th century, the guillotine chopped off the heads of aristocrats, priests, and other enemies of God, reason, and humanity. And there will come a time, I fervently believe it, when no one will be burnt, no one will be decapitated, when there will be no senseless forms and rites, no contracts and no stipulations on feeling, no duty and obligation, and we shall not yield to will, but to love alone. When there will be no husbands and wives, but lovers and mistresses. There will be neither rich nor poor, neither kings nor subjects. There will be brethren, there will be men, and at the word of the Apostle Paul, Christ will pass his power to the Father, and Father reason will hold sway once more, but this time in a new heaven and above a new world. I want the golden age, not the former unreasoning golden age of the beast, but the one that has been prepared by society, laws, marriage, in a word, by everything that was in its time essential, but is now stupid and vulgar. And that will be effected through sociality, and hence there is no object more noble and lofty than to contribute towards its progress and development. But it is absurd to imagine that this could happen by itself, with the aid of time, without violent changes, without bloodshed. Men are so insensate that they must forcibly be led to happiness. And of what significance is the blood of thousands compared to the degradation and sufferings of the millions? Well, you can hear Rousseau back in there forcing people to be free, among much else. But by this time, Belinsky had himself this is fairly early with Belinsky. It's 1841. It's 7 years before he died. It's the year before Dostoevsky, several years before Dostoevsky met him. And in the course, this 1841, this is the year Marx received his PhD in philosophy, you'll remember. From this launching pad in 1841, Belinsky educated himself in terms of the French writers, the writers from of left-wing Hegelianism. He was acquainted with Feuerbach. He had read by the time Dostoevsky knew him and became his daily confidant virtually. He had read several of the early pieces of Marx, including, for example, the Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right. A whole mosaic, then, of influences moving more and more toward the kind of eclectic, radical revolutionism against which Dostoevsky contends in the period after the Siberian years. And of course, you think particularly of The Possessed, where the Nechayev case has prompted the writing of the novel, and you think, of course, of The Brothers Karamazov. Now, what I'm suggesting is that Dostoevsky's political writing, whatever else he is doing, insofar as he has a political interest, and I'm not concerned particularly with the politics of Dostoevsky as the confidant of Pobedonostsev in the period after 1873, when he has become the favorite of the court. I think that one really, in a case of a great writer such as Dostoevsky, prima facie, and certainly I'm satisfied after my little reading of his work, that this is justifiable. One has to distinguish between the company one keeps in terms of his political pals and what he really thinks about things. All of us, I suppose, do that, don't we? And it would be a little surprising if a man of the range and intellect of a Dostoevsky did not do so. So I would suggest to you that one has to contrast or use very carefully the publicist writings, contrast these with the work of the great novels, and particularly the Brothers Karamazov, in which it seems to me he has brought together his thought in a way which is authoritative and which levels a critique against the ideological politics of the westernizers among the intelligentsia, which is devastating. Now, if you read your New York Review of Books this week, you'll know that Philip Rov really should be here so that he could argue about all of this, because as it happens, he has just said that really under Dostoevsky's apparent rapport with not only court circles, but also his rapport with orthodoxy, there is, in fact, not only a foot in the other camp, but there is a very strong leading toward a kind of, for lack of a better word, Rousseauistic golden age, which always fascinated him and which he really never let go of. Now, I think that there's a certain merit in understanding this in this way. Rob is, after all, a good scholar, and he does know his stuff. But what I think he inadequately appreciates, and what I can scarcely, I think, try to suggest to you in any detail here today, is that Dostoevsky was an extremely, by my reading of his work, profound Christian, not simply a doctrinal Christian. I think Nicholas Zernoff is right, and Berdyaev is more or less right, in seeing Dostoevsky as a religious mystic. And I think that we tend in our reading of Dostoevsky to equate our understanding of Christianity, which is typically Protestant or Roman Catholic, with Dostoevsky's understanding of Christianity, and that won't do either, since after all, Greek Orthodoxy and Russian Orthodoxy do have some rather significant differentia from any type of Western Christianity. And as far as Rav's argument is concerned, this is fresh in my mind since I read it on the plane coming up here yesterday, the rapport between nature and Christianity is much profounder than in Western varieties of Christianity. There is, after all, the theme of the redemption of the cosmos itself. It's not enough to save the souls of men. What do we do about the sticky leaves and the blades of grass? What do we do about the whole cosmos itself, which is understood to be in process of redemption from the standpoint of the profoundest stratum of Greek and Russian mysticism? And Dostoevsky himself was steeped in literature of this kind. He was a profound student of all of this material. And in dissecting his lines, I come to the conclusion, for example, that he has literally drawn the substance of his portrayal in The Grand Inquisitor from the writing of John of Damascus. This on the basis of a comparison of the texts themselves. And this rather lays to rest the insistence that you have to choose between a deep and profound rapport with nature on one hand and an ascetic kind of spirituality on the other, since on this reading the cosmos is itself divine, and the redemption which Christians in this tradition seek is a redemption which entails the redemption through participation by men of the whole of the creation and not only the human elements of the divine creation. The politics, therefore, of Dostoevsky, as I would suggest this to you, entails a very wide-ranging conception of reality itself. It recognizes that what is wrong with Westernization is not that science and technology are in themselves intrinsically bad, because he flatly puts that kind of misunderstanding of his work to rest, I think, in his letter of 1880 to Professor A.D. Gradovsky in the diary of the writer. Science and technology, yes, indeed, we must have from the West and welcome these in. But what is essential to man qua human is that he live to the fullness of his humanity, and in Dostoevsky's conception, the spiritual dimension of man's existence is the very quintessence of his humanity. Hence, any kind of political order which is destructive of this dimension of his existence, any attempt to find a false ground of being other than the being which is identified with the divine and the eternal, he reckons to be a menace, and there isn't much question in anybody's mind that the ground which is supplied by a Kant or by a Marx is not a ground which opens the possibility of relating men individually or societies in terms of their social order to the overriding divine order of being. And finally, I would say that it is precisely in the legend of the Grand Inquisitor where this point is communicated. Because reflect, if you will, that though Christ says only three words, nonetheless, when you recollect the episode, you may hear only the Inquisitor's arguments.
You may recall only his words, but you see only Christ. And this, I would say, is the answer of the heart, not simply in the obscurantist faith of a Russian who was perhaps not discriminating philosophically, but rather of a great mystic who understood that about things transcendent, we mortals can say nothing at all.
Thank you.